Hello and welcome to Cityscape's brand new podcast, Cityscape Wire, where we're taking you behind the scenes of the dynamic world of women in real estate. I'm your host, Tanisha, and if you've been following us, you know that on this podcast, we're embarking on a journey through the Middle East and North African region, unearthing the stories of trailblazing women who are redefining the real estate sector. And on today's podcast, I'm speaking to passionate climate activist and clean energy advocate, Elsie Milan. Elsie is the first Lebanese female representative to the Youth for Climate and Pre-COP. She's an MTE climate ambassador in partnership with the World Bank, and she was chosen by the United Nations Development Programme for Climate as one out of five most promising climate advocates in the MENA region. She tells me about her climate journey, her groundbreaking research into cement, and how youth-led climate action initiatives are driving solutions for a sustainable future. Elsie, welcome to the Cityscape Wire podcast. I'm so happy to have you here today.
Thank you so much. The pleasure is all mine.
I mean, you have quite an impressive CV for someone who is really young. You are incredibly passionate about climate justice. Let's talk about how you got started. What made you become aware and really kicked off your activism in Lebanon?
So that's kind of a stereotypical story of a small town girl who was born and raised in Lebanon. I don't know if you've ever visited Lebanon, but it's an atypical country in the Middle East because it's the only one that doesn't have a desert, only Arab country with no desert, but it's also bordered by the beautiful Mediterranean Sea. I mean, growing up in Beirut, studying at the American University was for me like a way to look beyond this horizon, live in this beautiful ecosystem, learning that we have more than 90, you know, maritime species in our sea and, you know, the beautiful cedar. I mean, I was always passionate about reforestation. I lived a very sustainable life at home. My father actually had grew his own, our own vegetables, our fruits, and we had olives. And olive season was for us something, you know, like a family event. We would, you know, collect the olives, make the oil. And living in this relationship very close to nature, you grow up and you believe that you're living in paradise. Well, what else can go wrong? But gradually you start seeing that there is something wrong. Why is our sea polluted? Why is my cedar only present in the flag? I only have like a couple of cedars in the country. And why aren't our crops growing? Why aren't our olives producing the way they used to before? And you start asking yourself these questions and you relate them to a phenomenon that was, when I was young, very underrated, and it's climate change.
So was it just this first understanding of asking these questions that really kicked off your climate justice attitude? Or did your entire family have this, I suppose, while you were growing up?
It was living in this environment makes you realize that why isn't there a steady state or a constant evolution from one year to the other? And why is the temperature changing? Why are these phenomena around us happening? But it's also the fact that you see that it's man-made. I call it the man-made climate change or the man-advanced climate change, because in my country, in 2015, we had the waste crisis, and we were all over the news with the waste crisis. We were turning from this paradise in the Middle East to this big dump. And then, you know, these emissions that were polluting everything, you start asking your parents, what is happening? What is that? But the older generation does not have this concept of climate change. They do not have this concept that there's an urgency and we need to act. And then you gradually start doing your research. You gradually start looking at the events that are happening around. And you see that if at the same time my country is facing this problem, and in Paris in 2015, countries gathered to the first pact that will change the world forever, which is the Paris Agreement, then you start putting the dots together and you link them together. And I think that's mainly what drove me into taking action and being involved in the space.
Wow. That's such a good point about the urgency. I think that there's such an urgency amongst youngsters when it comes to climate change. I mean, it's quite infectious, which is great. Which sort of leads me on to my next question. Your credentials are really impressive for someone so young. You're the first Lebanese female representative to the Youth for Climate and Pre-COP. I mean, you were chosen by UNDP Climate as one out of five most promising climate advocates in the MENA region. That's just amazing. And these are just two of the, you know, the many accolades that you have. So let's talk about some of your highlights being part of this and how you've seen progress over the last few years being made in the built environment.
Thank you so much. I mean, it's always incredible. Whenever someone mentions these, I look back and I think how the movement evolved and how we as youth changed. When I was chosen to do the Youth for Climate and I was chosen to take part in that big event at that time, it was right after COVID. And for me, it felt that it was, you know, yeah, it was like COVID is about to end. We all have taken the vaccine by then, hopefully. And we would be all able to gather in one place to fight climate change. Now, the United Nations Youth Envoy sent a call and, you know, I was chosen and I went there. The first year when I was at the event, and it was around 2021, you would be in this space where there are youth like you, and you look at them and you see and you hear their problems. And the first thing you think about is, I'm not alone. I mean, someone from Latin America, from Brazil, from Chile can have the same problems as me. I knew these people that are now, we evolved together. I mean, that I saw at COP28 a couple of months ago, and we reflected on how much this advanced, how this very niche thing that was in 2021, right after COVID, became now this involvement where everyone wants to be part of it. Everyone wants to relate their own sector or their own craft to a sustainable lifestyle or to fight climate change. And that was an incredible thing. So I think there are two ways of having these recognitions. They help you in two ways. So first, they integrate you more in the space. So they allow you to meet people who otherwise you would never think you could meet ever. Like, for example, when I did the Youth for Climate, I met people from the World Bank who later on helped me become part of Connect for Climate and the climate ambassadors there. I met, for example, John Kerry, and I had the chance to talk to this person who is, you know, who's one of the prominent figures in climate policies in the United States. And they give you the space to learn more, but they also give you the credibility. I mean, if you're accredited by UNDP Climate, this gives you a legitimate position to talk from. And that's how you can encourage more people into taking action. Because when they hear you, they see someone just like them who is actively working towards fighting climate change. And they ask themselves, okay, I want to be part of this. Let me get in touch with this person and let's do something together.
What does it mean to be a climate ambassador? What does it mean to really, I suppose, champion climate justice? And what does it mean to you?
So in the literal sense, to be the climate ambassador to be a Max Tabitha Atkins climate ambassador, it is a program that was launched by Connect for Climate, which is a unit part of the World Bank that chooses every year youth around the world to work on principles that fight climate change. So what we do, we attend several workshops. But to be able to be accredited as a climate ambassador, you have to implement actions on the national and regional level. So you either have to take part in events, you have to work with NGOs, you have to implement projects on small scale or larger scale, just to kind of implement everything you learn, everything you know. And that's how you become part of a cohort that later on takes part in other events. I was part of the first cohort of climate ambassadors. The second year, I was chosen also to speak on behalf of the climate ambassadors at the Innovate for Climate event that took part in Bilbao in Spain. So this is what it means. It means that you're someone who is not, you know, there's a problem that I see in our field is that sometimes youth, when they talk, they do not have the adequate scientific knowledge to be heard. you have to have the scientific knowledge, no matter how advanced or elementary it is, but you need to be knowledgeable, and you need to implement actions on the ground. You cannot help the people if you don't know the people. And that's what being an ambassador like. It's representing the youth of your country, youth who otherwise would never have a voice. I mean, if you look at the Lebanese parliament, oh my God, it's a house, it's a retirement home. All these people are like 50 plus. There's nothing wrong with having decision makers that are old, but they are wise, hopefully. But you need to have youth, because if you cannot see yourself in the future, you cannot change it. And that's why a lot of countries like the UAE today are leading the world, because their leaders are visionary. And sometimes only the youth can be visionary. And being a climate ambassador is being someone visionary who includes everyone and who tries to bring everyone to take action, to motivate them to work.
I can hear your passion. And that's why it's so nice to hear that, especially what you're saying about one, about how the youth need to have scientific knowledge to back up what they're saying. I mean, it's one thing to be an activist for climate justice and for seeing things change. But it's another thing to really have that scientific backing, and just how you need to have the youth in order to really change things. And I think this is perhaps one of the things that was also talked about at COP. It's not just about talking about things, it's about leading to action. And you said something earlier about how the job of the climate ambassador is to make sure that from talking, it leads to action. Can you give me some examples of how things in the last few years where you've been a climate ambassador, where you've talked about something and then it's actually led to on-the-ground action?
So as you know, I'm Lebanese, but I'm also now living in the United Kingdom. So you have these two clashing worlds where you talk about something somewhere and you believe it has to be implemented, but it's not really implemented. While in other spaces, you have a lot of impact. But I do believe that, for example, after the Youth for Climate, we drafted a Youth for Climate manifesto. I don't really agree with the name. But, you know, having this big document gathered all the demands of youth from different sectors, what you want to be implemented. And we had a version in Arabic. Now, when I was back to Lebanon, I had a meeting with the Minister of Environment in Lebanon, Dr. Nasser Yassin, who I believe is doing great in the country in terms of fighting climate change and enhancing the environmental awareness. So I met with him, I presented him with a copy in Arabic, and we discussed a bit what could be the strategies that youth can be involved in, what are the things that we want from the ministry, for example, in our country to work on. And gradually, and I hope I'm part of his thought whenever he's doing that, he's working on a lot of strategies for waste management, he's working on reforestation projects. I'm also working with, so after the Beirut, as you know, in Lebanon, we had a big explosion, the August 4th explosion. Our port literally exploded. Our country collapsed. Our capital was in rubbles. So everybody went, you know, the basic instinct of a person who is seeing his country, you know, being destroyed is to, you know, go to the ground, get on the ground, try to help, clean, save people. I was doing that, and then I realized, okay, so the country is destroyed. The capital is gone. We have to do something. I was back then at the American University of Beirut, and I co-founded an initiative with a professor that is the first academic initiative in the MENA region that transforms final year projects, like engineers' final year projects, into sustainable businesses. So we provide them with coaching, we provide them with links to transform their ideas or their final year projects into startups if they're interested in doing that. So I came up with this idea to have mini series that hosts people who are actually on the ground with their businesses, with their initiatives, trying to clean Beirut and to help rehabilitate it. So we had people who work at the Lebanese Waste Management Association who are, you know, specializing in recycling and waste management. We had one of our professors, Dr. Najat Saliba, who later on became an MP. She's a big environmentalist, and she won the L'Oréal Prize for Women in Science. So we wanted to shed light on her so the youth can see that they can have an environmentalist voice in the parliament, and she reached parliament, which is amazing. We had a lot of environmental engineers. We had, I can name you a lot of names, people who had the vision of how Beirut can be sustainable. And the first question you would ask them, how do you see Beirut to be sustainable? I mean, these short videos reached the cohort, the university, the students, and you're giving a space and a platform for people back then who didn't have a platform. And today, all of them, like I maintain very good contacts with them, and we see how much they're working for the country and how they're working on, you know, making it more sustainable. And this is another thing that I'm very proud of doing. A third thing, I was part, I'm still an EU Gilles connector, and it's part of the EU Neighborhood South initiative. So the EU chooses youth that work on different causes to bridge between, let's say, in our case, the southern neighborhood and the European Union, and to talk more about the EU projects in the region. And last year, I was able to take part in the EU Open Days, where I went to Brussels to the headquarters, and I was able to meet with the engineer, and we sat and we talked a bit about what we see the role of the EU, what is the role of the EU in helping the region, taking advantage of our natural resources like solar and wind, and to create renewable, to give a space to renewable energy. And I think these are some of the things that I pride myself in doing throughout my career.
This is Cityscape Wire.
You have a background in engineering. You're a chemical engineer. I know you're currently studying towards your PhD, and I mean, you're doing amazing stuff in a lot of things, especially cement for the built environment. Can you tell us more about it? And tell us about, especially about cement and how it will change the built environment in the future.
So what I do is I come from a chemical engineering background, and I saw that what the technologies we work on, they won't be implemented if there are no adequate policies to tackle them. So I decided, I got the President's Scholarship to do a PhD in environmental policy at Imperial College London, where I'm currently based. So I'm doing my PhD in developing a novel decision-making framework to de-risk and encourage the adoption of carbon capturing, utilization, and storage for hard-to-abate industries. And it's a very controversial topic. But I chose hard-to-abate industries such as chemicals, iron and steel, and cement, because without CCUS, these industries will not move forward, especially cement. You can still electrify chemicals or iron and steel, but you can never electrify cement. And cement is, you know, the real estate sphere, the buildings, the urbanization, everything is based on cement. I mean, if you want to develop your country, make work on this rural environment, you have to use cement. It's a very important commodity, and it's essential. And there's no other way but adopt CCUS. So through these policies, what I do is I gather data, obviously, for the countries that are the biggest producers of cement. Then we look at the policies, if they have policies related to the adoption of CCUS in cement, and hopefully to provide them with a framework and scenario that can work on the national level, where they can implement their own policies based on their economic and their economic model, and enhance regional collaboration and hopefully international partnerships. Now, why is this important? Because the production of cement is a big emitter. So cement is a big emitter of CO2. Now, we can talk about different emissions, but what I do is just CO2 emissions. And you cannot move forward in the energy transition or in reaching net zero without tackling all commodities or all sectors. And you have to add to speak about the elephant in the room, which is cement. So if we're able to enhance these, to use these policies to enhance sustainable cement production, then you can still use cement, but at the same time, you are decreasing emissions and you're working, you're making this very polluting sector towards, you're transforming it towards a sector that is hopefully sustainable.
You mentioned before that you work, or you sort of look at the data when it comes to the biggest producers of cement in terms of countries. Who are the biggest producers of cement?
So obviously you have Gulf regions, they play the big role. You have the US, and obviously the US, the EU, these big entities. But then if you look deeper, you need to look at national levels as well. I mean, also when you look at big producers, you have to look at the producers that are, you know, on the national level, on the local level, because it's very hard to look at regional collaborations and just say, okay, this is the biggest producer. But then you start asking yourself, is it the biggest producer with respect to the economy? Now, obviously, you have big countries like China, India, the US, that are the big producers. And these countries are very important because these countries are also leading the world in all fields. China, for example, is a leading producer in 2022. Vietnam is also on the map. The US, Brazil, Russia, Saudi Arabia. So depending on the economy, we can talk about their production in numbers, but we need to also talk about their size in the political sphere as well as the economic sphere. And when you see big poles like China and the US being these big producers, who are also should be leading the world in climate action or in development of policies, then you ask yourself, how important are these policies to be implemented? Because these countries impact others. So if you develop policies that are adequate for China and the US, and if they accept adopting them, and if you see a future in carbon reductions, then all the other countries orbiting around them will also kind of be influenced and
will follow. That's such a good point. I mean, you were at the recent COP in Dubai in November last year. Let's talk about your role here and just some of the big success stories that you felt came out of it.
You know, when I joined COP, I was leaving the International Renewable Energy Agency and I was joining Imperial College, and there were a few badges back then. And I really, that's the biggest COP. I want to be there. Get me a badge. So yeah. I was nagging the whole time that I wanted a badge. So I got the observer badge and I joined the Imperial delegation to COP. The moment Dr. Sultan Al-Jaber struck the gavel, I knew this was going to be a big COP. And if we look at the consensus, and I love the term consensus because it was an agreement, so nobody was was heavily disappointed. I hope everyone was pleased with the outcome. That was not the fairy tale everybody wanted, but all parties came to somehow an agreement. I was really, so as an observer, obviously you can't access the negotiations. So you take part in side events in the blue zone. I took part in many side events. I was happy to, you know, take part in events by the International Energy Agency where I sat with indigenous communities. And we talked a bit about the technology that I work on and how it could impact indigenous communities. And that's one of the things that we did. But another thing that I was really impressed by were the pledges. So mainly the tripling of renewable energy deployment pledge. And I was intrigued by the term of unabated fossil fuel, or we need to stop. And if you look at Article 6, we see unabated fossil fuels, which leaves space to each country to adopt the technology that they see fit to their own economic system to decrease emissions. And this is how I saw, like, the UAE is not, through the UAE consensus, you're not dictating the way of countries. Like, you're not telling your country, a specific country, need to do this, this, and that. You're giving them a target and you're giving them liberty to use the technology that fits them best. And I think this is a leap forward, as well as the investments that were made in other areas, like in health and biodiversity. So everything was, I knew this was going to be the COP of energy. I knew energy will be at the heart of COP28, obviously because it's an oil producing country, an oil and gas producing country. But I was really intrigued by the way the problem would be approached and how solutions would be elaborated. And I was impressed by the space. So you would have protests, but there would be kind of civil protests. There were no clashes, no fights. Everything was safe. It was a safe space for people to express their ideas. You could see people from different communities, from different backgrounds taking the stage. Side events were filled with young people. So I was so happy. And I said that throughout the sessions I was part of, I'm so happy to see people, young people in panel discussions, sitting with experts, sitting with indigenous communities, sitting with academics, discussing their ideas. So that was also a big space given to youth. And just having everyone from decision making, from the decision maker, from the decision makers deciding on targets and elaborating partnerships for a way forward, that was very interesting.
I mean, you said something really interesting in an interview. You said that people have said caring about the climate is something for the privileged, which I think is you are right. It's a really big misconception. What are some of the other big misconceptions when it comes to understanding the urgency for climate change or to act on preventing climate change?
I saw that people who are coming from privileged backgrounds are looking at climate change. I mean, let's look a bit at the history of the movement that is climate change. You see that these are the countries of the developing countries, the developing economies that raised the problem. Those were not the economies that were actually suffering. Okay, everybody's suffering from climate change. We're all in this together. But there's a big disparity between countries in Africa who are suffering from energy poverty, who do not have access to electricity, and you have country. There's a big difference between them and people, I don't know, living in France who have electricity 24/7. And it's weird enough that the developed countries, were the one who raised this issue and pushed for it. And now we're bringing on board everybody else. I know this can come from consciousness and colonial past, but let's put that aside and look at these other developing countries who now believe that there are bigger problems to tackle. And this is another misconception that climate change, if you fight climate change, you're fighting in a closed, it's a loop, you know? People from developing economies or people suffering from energy poverty, suffering from economic crises, social problems, wars, for example, they don't know that tackling climate change in general will solve all these problems. If you work, for example, on renewable, if you promote renewable energies, you're decreasing oil and gas shipment. And when you decrease this shipping of oil and gas, you're self-reliant, you're creating new jobs, you're promoting green welfare. And that's how you're working in a loop. You're decreasing the economic burden. So people don't really understand that climate change is something that tackles every aspect of your life. It's not just, oh, we're losing a tree. Oh, I can't go swimming this year. Right. No, this is, oh, it's raining a lot. Oh, it's not raining. Oh, it's a curse. It's not going to rain this year. It's not a curse. I mean, it is a scientific problem. It has been proven. So people, this is a misconception that people don't relate it to their everyday lives. The second thing is, it's the actions that we take now will need time to start showing effect. It's like a scientific experiment. Whenever you do a scientific experiment, the first day you start seeing an improvement or a better or a specific development. The third day you'll see another. The week after you see bigger improvements. So it's not like a wand or like a magic spell that you just say and you make a change or you make the change that you want. And this is what people also do not really understand, is that if I make an improvement today, true, I'm not going to change everything in one single day, but I will make an improvement. And trust me, people like to see the results immediately. They don't like to wait. So they're very impatient. As humans, we're very impatient. This is another thing. And these are, I think, the basic misconceptions. And it also comes from the elitist language that is employed in the field. When you talk about technologies, if I talk to you, if we're two people who do not know anything, for example, about climate change, and somebody talks to us about, I don't know, blue hydrogen, green hydrogen, we're going to be like, what is that? I don't understand this language. I don't understand the terms. We have to make these terms accessible to everyone. This should be like basic culture that everyone should have and be able to translate it. Trust me, like in full confidentiality, I mean, there are a lot of people listening, but but in full confidentiality, before COP28, I was invited to a discussion on France 24, on the TV channel, and it was in Arabic. And when I was saying the words in Arabic, it felt weird saying, let's say, instead of fossil fuel, al-wuqood al-ahfuri, which is, if you hear the term, it's very difficult it's not a term that is malleable. It's not something in our culture. And from my language to all other languages, to people speaking French, Spanish, to other language of the Southern Hemisphere, especially in China and India, these communities that are really working a lot on their economy and on industries, and they have a lot of potential to be part of this sphere. And you start thinking, are they facing the same problems? Do they have access to these different jargons and these different terms?
Even though it affects them on a daily, like every single day, and they don't know these terms. That you're so right about the language that we employ to talk about
climate change. It should be inclusive. It should include everyone, and everyone should understand what these terms are and what do they mean and how they relate to our everyday lives. I mean, how can you change the people if you don't know the people?
I mean, I suppose it's part of that process that needs to change. That definitely needs to change. That is really insightful. My goodness. Well, we have to talk about challenges. I know we talked about a lot of the challenges, but I suppose it's a segue. You mentioned earlier that policy needs to change. So let's talk about, you know, challenges you're seeing in the built environment when it comes to climate crisis. And what do you think we need to do to change our behaviors and our mindsets?
Mindsets are very difficult to change. You can write policies as much as you want, but if you don't have the approval of the people, or if you don't have the understanding of the people, it's very hard. We as humans, we tend to be convinced of certain ideas and we believe them, and it's very hard to change these ideas. If you look at our goals are set to 2030, 2050. When you think about it, we're closer to 2030 than 2015. You see, we're closer to 2030.
Gosh, we are. That's scary.
Yeah. Yeah. Are actions matching this timeline? And why is that? I mean, if there's innovation, if there's a big leap of innovation, if people, think tanks, are working on policies as well as researchers, okay, where's the problem? Where's the gap? And it's in the people themselves. There's a big concept of the not in my backyard, which is, you know, do whatever you want, but don't do it in my region. Don't do it in my city. Don't do it where I live. And just keep me away from you know, your projects. But it's also, it shows you the individualistic thinking that we have. We don't think as a community. And I think this is what's preventing us from moving forward. It's very hard to change the people. And this is why awareness is very important, and it's still relevant to the movement of this built environment. You have to change the people through education, through awareness. Have this change, because you still have conflicting generations that are making the decisions. You have the youth on the street, you have the elder generation on the seats, and you have a big wall between them.
And hopefully your generation can sort of bridge that gap.
We hope so.
Well, okay, let's do rapid fire questions. If it were in your power, what one thing would you change right now in the fight against climate change?
Oh my God, that would be the mindsets. Like, have collective mindsets instead of individualistic mindsets. Have empathy. I think that's the most important thing.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. I thought you'd go for something like a policy change, but no, mindsets. You change mindsets and you change policy.
Mindsets change. Exactly. Change the people. You change. I don't want to say change the people. It's a very political term. I mean, have the people work together. I mean, have these walls like broken down and people thinking about each other, and you can fix all problems.
That is true. And finally, what advice would you give to people who don't know how to get involved in fighting climate change?
Just find, climate change is everywhere. Find what interests you and what you're passionate about, and just jump. Ask the questions, meet the people. My mom always says, what's the worst that could happen? Well, you can get rejected, fine. You'll be accepted somewhere else. Someone will love your idea, someone will hate it. That's the way of life. But find what you love and work towards it, and never back down, and always push forward.
Oh, that's actually a beautiful way to end this. Oh, Elsie, Thank you so much. This has been really insightful. And yeah, it's really great to speak to you for, you know, someone who's doing amazing things on the sustainability front. Good luck in everything you do. And yeah, look forward to talking to you next.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast, then tune in every month. We will be speaking to inspiring women from all walks of life and at various stages of their careers, exploring their challenges and uncovering the secrets behind their success. Join us where we'll be breaking down barriers and bridging gaps in the world of real estate. This is Cityscape Wire.